The scripture reading for this morning comes from what is probably to most Christians a rather obscure book. It's the book of 2 Kings, and it describes the history of the kingdom of Israel, along with 1 Kings and 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Chronicles, told in different time periods. And this is the events in the centuries following the kingships of David and Solomon. During this time, the kingdom of Israel had split into two kingdoms. The two tribes in the south were called Judea, or Judah, and the northern ten tribes, Israel. And so this story takes place in the kingdom of Israel, and the context is that during this time period, there was constant warfare. As an empire that bordered on the kingdom of Israel was trying to conquer it, and eventually they did, about a century and a half after the time period of this story. So we find the city of Samaria, which is one of the larger cities and was actually the capital of the kingdom of Israel, and it is besieged, completely surrounded. And then for comic relief, we have this wonderful little story about four lepers. Now there were four leprous men outside the city gate who said to one another, "Why should we sit here until we die? If we say, 'Let us enter the city,' the famine is in the city and we'll die there. But if we sit here, we shall also die. Therefore, let us desert to the Aramean camp. If they spare our lives, we shall live. And if they kill us, we shall but die." So they arose at twilight to go to the Aramean camp, but when they came to the edge of the Aramean camp, there was no one there at all. For the Lord had caused the Aramean army to hear the sound of chariots and horses and the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, "The king of Israel has hired the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Egypt to fight against us." So they fled away in the twilight and abandoned their tents, their horses, and their donkeys, leaving the camp just as it was. And they fled for their lives. When these leprous men had come to the edge of the camp, they went into a tent, ate and drank, carried off silver and gold and clothing, and went back and hid them. And then they came back, entered another tent, carried off things from it, and they went and hid them. Then they said to one another, "What we're doing is wrong. This is a day of good news. If we are silent and wait until the morning light, we will be found guilty. Therefore, let us go and tell the king's household." So they came and called to the gatekeepers of the city and told them, "We went to the Aramean camp, but there was no one to be seen or heard there, nothing but the horses tied, the donkeys tied, and the tents that they were." And then the gatekeepers called out and proclaimed it to the king's household. I want to tell you a story about a place in Monmouth, Maine, where my first wife and I served a couple of congregations. There was a stretch of road between Lewiston and Auburn, Maine, U.S. Route 202, and in the stretch between Monmouth, which is sort of halfway in between the two, between Monmouth or Lewiston and Augusta, there's a long stretch of road that's very, very empty. There's really not anything there to speak of, except for what used to be a restaurant. Now, the thing that was pretty distinctive about this restaurant is that it had in front of it, on a metal pole that was at least 20 feet high, a huge fiberglass steer, a cow. And this thing was bigger than a cow. It was about the size of an automobile. It was huge. And people had told us that the restaurants that had occupied that building would last for about, oh, maybe a year or so, and then they would go under. We ate up there once, and it really wasn't all that good, and it wasn't hard to understand why that particular one, when it did, went under. And so during the 8 years that we were there, I have to think at least two or three restaurants came and went out of the same building. And here was the thing, that because of that cow up on the post, they always had to make it a steakhouse. Because, I mean, you're not going to have a Chinese restaurant with this huge cow up on the pole, right? Or an Italian restaurant or something like that. It had to be a steakhouse. Well, one permutation of it was a surf and turf, so you could get, you know, beef and seafood. That was about the closest they got to originality. So one restaurant came and went, one after the other. Well, a while back, I thought of this cow that stuck in my mind. And this is one of those things that once you see it, you'd never forget it. And I wondered what had happened to that place. And so poking around online, I discovered what had happened. Somebody had turned it into a farm supply and feed store. And the cow was still there. Now think about it. What better advertising could you have for a farm supply store than a huge cow up on a pole? Perfect. And from what I understood, the store is doing great. It's not the kind of thing where, like a restaurant, where many restaurants, of course, get by either on reputation or people drive by and they're hungry. Didn't matter anymore. People went to that farm supply store, doing a bang-up business. And there was the cow up on top of the pole. Now, the new people who had bought that probably had in mind that they wanted to open a feed store, and then this vacant building came up, I would imagine, and there it was. Perfect. Perfect opportunity. And the cow, of course, was the cherry on top. But it took somebody to think differently. Everybody who had run a restaurant in that store, because it looked like a restaurant, it had restaurant equipment in it, what else were you going to do with the building? Except have a restaurant. They were stuck. They were absolutely stuck with something from the past. Because you could just imagine how expensive it would be to get that cow off that pole. And then what would you do with it after? The cow was a liability. But what the owners of that feed store did was they turned it into an asset. And what they learned, obviously, and I've got to call them someday, and I haven't done that yet, but sometime when I have nothing else to do, I might do that. But obviously, they took something from the past that was a liability and turned it into an asset, but they turned their backs on the rest of the past. Because it had been clear over the span of goodness knows how many years that a restaurant was not going to do well in that particular location. And if anything, what they were able to do was look to the past and find an example of what they shouldn't do. The lepers in our story realize very early on that to go into the city was not a good idea, partly because they were lepers, but also because there was nothing there. People were starving. The city was completely surrounded by an enemy army. It couldn't go back. It just wasn't going to be a good idea. And so as they sit there for a moment outside the city walls, they realize we can't go back into the city because we're going to die. We can't stay here because we're going to die. All we can do is go off into the future It's unknown. We don't know what the Arameans are going to do to us, but they may do something. And if they do, then we have nothing else to worry about. And if they don't, then they let us live. Now, just prior to this, the king of Samaria had come to the prophet Elisha, who was the successor of Elijah, and he had said, there's no hope with this. The Samaritan army, or the Aramean army is coming. They're going to surround our city. Maybe what we should do would be just to curl up our toes and die. But Elisha has something different in mind. He says, no. That a day from now, people are going to be buying and selling food at the normal prices, not at the high prices they are now because it's in such short supply. In other words, don't give up. And your rescue is going to be coming soon. And so the lepers go out to the Aramean camp, having absolutely no idea what is waiting for them there. They assume that the Arameans are there. They find the camp empty. The army had heard sounds during the night. Maybe it was thunder or something. We don't know. But they ran off because they were afraid that the Samaritan army was going to come and just blow right over them along with all their hired mercenaries. No. Camp was empty. Well, just imagine your reaction if you wandered into a place that was full of all kinds of great stuff, food and riches and comfortable places to sit and eat and sleep. What would you do? You pull out your fork and your knife and you chow down, right? Well, that's what they did. Until one of them says, wait a minute. What we're doing is wrong. This is a day of good news. What we need to do is to go back to the city and tell them about the camp that's been abandoned and this wonderful thing that has happened, and then everybody's going to have food to eat. And so that's what they do. They go back to the city. They tell the king's messengers. It's announced to the city, and everybody comes out, and they have themselves a block party. It's great. And there is so much that we can learn. There's so much that we can learn from this story about these four guys who realize that it's important to share the good stuff that they find. The Protestant church in this country is at a crossroads. We are in the midst of significant cultural change that we cannot control. We can't stop it. We can't halt it. Can't even slow it down. And it's true all around in the country to varying degrees. New Hampshire, where Anita and I lived until just recently, along with Vermont and Alaska, are the least religious states in the entire country, and churches struggle because we don't know quite yet what the future is going to be. What the lepers realize is that the only way they can, only thing that they can do is to go forward. Sisters and brothers, we're kind of in the same situation. Our culture is changing around us. It changes our day-to-day lives. And it is changing who we are as a church. And most of us can probably remember the good old days. Everybody's got good old days, don't? Does everybody have good old days? Remember good old days? I remember growing up in Center Church in Meriden, and Sunday school was full, and the church was full, and there were just lots of people around, and it never occurred to anybody that this could change. It never occurred to us that it could change, but it has for every church. We can decide whether it's good or bad, and we can spend lots of time talking about that, but in the end, that's not going to help us very much. And what is behind us now is something that we can't go back to, not in the same way. And there's no point in staying just where we are. The thing to do, just like the lepers say, is we've got to go out into the unknown. But what we find out there, even with what may seem to be uncertainties and threats, will be much better and richer than what we had before. Because we can't assume that everybody in town is going to go to church. It just doesn't happen. And we can't assume that people are going to be able to come to activities in the middle of the day, in the middle of the week, because everybody works. What worked in the past may not work today. In fact, chances are it probably won't. But we can still do what we have always done. It's important for us to hear, and you hear me say this a lot over the years, it is important for us to distinguish between what we do and how we do it. The distinction between what we do and how we do it. What we do always stays the same. How we do it changes. And I know that's the C word that everybody doesn't like. And we don't like change, but we also don't like the way things are. Sisters and brothers, we don't have time to sit and bemoan the loss of status of the Protestant church in this country. We don't have time because there is so much that needs to be done. And when we feel besieged by circumstances, we can know that we are not alone. And it is important to refocus on what we are to do. We can't go back in time. We can't stay as we are. The only thing to do is to go forward. And we are certainly not alone in having to do that. Every generation of the Christian church has had to learn how to adapt to the society around it and to minister to the communities in which it found itself. So what do? Well, we can think about the words of Jesus, for one thing, at the end of the Gospel of Matthew. Remember the Great Commission? Have you ever heard that? Go and make disciples of all nations, baptize them and teach them what I taught you, and remember, I am with you always until the end of the age. How's that for a guarantee? Go and baptize, teach them what I've taught you, and remember that I'm with you until the end of the age. That's what Jesus calls us to do. To make disciples. Not just to be something, but to do something, to make disciples. And with all the various things that it is involved in making disciples in 2015, this is what we are called to do. Go and baptize and teach and make disciples. That doesn't mean necessarily banging on people's doors or handing out tracts. We're not going to do that. But the gift that this church can offer, the community around it, is a model of inclusivity that works against the prevailing view in much of our society that people can be categorized and some are good and some are not good. We don't believe that. Or that God is simply a God of judgment and it is possible for Christians to call down judgment on others. Now, you'll never hear me say that. What God calls us to do is to witness to the mercy and grace and power of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which means things will always grow and things will always change, but what will never change is the presence of Christ with us. Amen.